Today, among other things, we will upgrade our math once more, twice more actually today. One is that we will finally do what I promised for a long time, which is that we will free ourselves from the choice of bases that comes with the coordinate system, the d by dxi and the dxj. We will see how to handle it if we grab the freedom to choose the bases at every point in space separately. So a basis in the tangent space, a basis in the cotangent space. We take the freedom to choose those spaces independently of the choice of coordinate system. Another thing, another step that we will do is this. We have tensor-valued functions, right? So we have functions that at every point in space-time give us a tensor. We will upgrade that so that we get tensor-valued differential forms. Now, that's not really entirely a new concept, because it's easy to get any one of those if we have a tensor that has two antisymmetric covariant indices, then we can view these two antisymmetric covariant indices, for example, as a two-form. And then the remaining indices are just the tensor-valuedness of that form. OK, so we will do, among other things, these two today. Let me start with a quick reminder of where we ended last time. I showed you the so-called Bianchi identities. Bianchi identities are useful identities that are due to just the underlying mathematics. Later on, we will see how they're related to diffeomorphism invariants. But for now, let's just take them as equations that hold irrespective of any physical laws. They're just coming about because of the mathematics of it. And we proved, for example, that the first Bianchi identity is really nothing but, well, it's been erased now, but the Jacobi identity for linear maps. So the Bianchi identities are, in principle, when you write them abstractly, relationships between the curvature map and the torsion map. Now, when the torsion is vanishing, then the right-hand side of this is vanishing, and also here we have something vanishing. So that simplifies these equations. And then if we write them out in coordinates, they become completely demystified because they become simply symmetries with respect to permutations of indices. So in a chart, assuming that there's no torsion, so of course this is then the case for general relativity, we obtain the following. So for the complete list, let's assume that there's no torsion. So the Bianchi identities simplify because of that. And let's also assume that we choose a coordinate system and the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces that come with the coordinate system. So the d by dxi for basis vectors in the tangent space, for example. Then a little calculation shows that these abstract Bianchi identities reduce to simply this, where this is the Riemann curvature tensor's coefficients. Remember, to be absolutely accurate, this is not a tensor. This is a bunch of scalar functions, right? These are the scalar coefficient functions of a tensor. And so what this is saying is that if you take the cyclic sum of these functions, then that's zero. So this means that if there's an index 1, this is 2, this is 3, then you have to add 1, 2, 3 plus 2, 3, 1 plus 3, 1, 2. The cyclic sum of the Riemann curvature tensor in its three lower indices is zero. That's the first Bianchi identity. And the second Bianchi identity involves a covariant derivative of the Riemann curvature tensor. And it says that this cyclic sum where we cyclically permute the K, L, and M indices is zero. So in practice, it's useful to just have that somewhere written down so that in practical calculations, you can always check, can I use one of those? And then if it's applicable, just use it to simplify things. Other useful properties that can be derived for the coefficient matrix of the Riemann curvature tensor. Other useful properties are these three. So what we have here is anti-symmetry in the last two indices. Okay. And here we have anti-symmetry in the first two indices if we lower this naturally upper index down. And then we also have symmetry when we interchange these two indices with those two indices. Those two can be understood from the Ricci identity. Remember what the Ricci identity said? It said that if you parallel transport a vector along a parallelogram, then you arrive back at the original point, assuming that there's no torsion, you will arrive back at the original point. And the vector that you parallel transported may now point in a different direction. It will not have changed length. It will, however, point in a different direction. And what that means is that if this was a Riemannian manifold, the vector has been rotated. If it's a pseudo-Riemannian manifold, the vector has undergone a Lorentz transformation. However, for an infinitesimal parallelogram, this is not a full rotation or a full Lorentz transformation, it's an infinitesimal one. And infinitesimal ones are generated by anti-symmetric matrices, if you remember. That's why two of those indices are anti-symmetric. The other two are anti-symmetric because these two are to be contracted with the two vectors that outline the parallelogram that you travel. Right? We said that if the two vectors are pointing in the same direction, then you're not actually doing a parallelogram. You're just going in some direction and coming back. So you're not expecting any shift in the direction of the vector that you parallel transport. So we get anti-symmetry in the two indices that you contract with your two vectors that define the parallelogram. And we get anti-symmetry in the first two because it's an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation or an infinitesimal rotation that we get. This one I don't have a simple interpretation for. However, I can't tell you in simple intuitive terms why that equation holds, why the first indices can be swapped with the third and the fourth index, but it has an interesting implication, which is that if this is a Riemannian manifold, so the metric has signature 111, then if it's a Riemannian manifold, this means that if you view I and j as one index, double index, and k and l as a double index, then R is a self-adjoint matrix. Okay? Now that's not true if it's an indefinite signature, because then you have to raise the indices and pick up minus signs. But not everywhere, but so it's not symmetric, not anti-symmetric because of that. But for a Riemannian manifold, it means that the Riemann curvature tensor is a self-adjoint operator with respect to this, the first two indices as an index, and the second two indices as an index. And then you can ask, well, okay, what are the eigenvalues? Because you can diagonalize it, right? And it turns out that the eigenvalues are the sectional curvatures. And the sectional curvatures are predating, actually, the Riemann curvature tensor. The sectional curvatures have an interpretation in space-time, so switching back to Lorentz transformation to the Lorentzian signature, where they basically describe the tidal forces. And for each plane, you choose a plane in your space-time, and then for each plane, you get tidal forces at this location. And the strength of the tidal force is given by the sectional curvature. And planes are defined by two vectors, and that's why you have these two indices there. I think later in the course, I will come back to that in a bit more detail. Now that we have all of these properties of the Riemann curvature tensor, we are ready to consider contractions of it. And by that, I mean it has four indices. Let's take two of them and contract them with another. Then we get the so-called Ricci tensor. But could we also get other tensors? For example, here we are contracting the upper index with the second lower index. Why the second one? Shouldn't we try to contract with the third one or with the first one? Well, if we contract with the third one, we get the same thing up to minus sign because of antisymmetry in here. But we can't contract with the first one because of antisymmetry in the two, if you remember. It was one of those identities. I mean, we can contract, but it would be zero. So we get a two tensor out of it, but it's zero. And it turns out there is just no other way. The only contraction that you can do of the Riemann curvature tensor with the metric to get down to a two tensor, from a four tensor to a two tensor, is this one that gives you the Ricci tensor. Up to a minus sign, this is unique. So if you write it out as a covariant two tensor, then remember this is not the tensor. This is a bunch of scalar coefficient functions. So you have this bunch of scalar coefficient functions multiplied with the bases in which we work. Remember, we're working with this so-called coordinate basis of the cotangent space here. And clearly, this thing is then an element of the cotangent space, of the tensor space of covariant two tensors. Now, this Ricci tensor, we can now contract with a metric to get a scalar. So we just multiply that with G, J, L, and sum over it, and we get a scalar, and there's no reason for this scalar to vanish because this is not antisymmetric. So from the Riemann curvature tensor, that is a 4 tensor, or really a 3,1 tensor, we obtain the Ricci tensor and the curvature scalar. And the previous Bianchi identities imply that one can show straightforwardly that this condition holds. That condition was super influential in the history of general relativity because it is necessary to obtain an analog to energy momentum conservation and diffeomorphism invariance. And so this guided this equation, as we will later see exactly how, this guided Einstein towards the right theory. This expression here in the bracket is called the Einstein tensor. So it is R minus 1/2 delta R. If you lower the index, then you get here Rik minus 1/2 and then G. Right? Remember that if you have a G with the lower indices, and the metric with the upper indices, and you contract one of them, did you get a Kronecker delta? The G has either two upper indices, two lower indices, or if you write it as with one upper and one lower index, well, then it's the Kronecker delta. Okay, so this thing in the bracket, the so-called Einstein tensor, has this property here that when we take the covariant derivative and then trace over that, that's zero. This is not exactly intuitive just yet, but we will get at this equation from various different perspectives. For now, let's just take it as a consequence of the Bianchi identities. So it's just a mathematical fact that no matter what equations of motion you'd use, it's just simply a fact that on any space-time, whether or not it solves the Einstein equation, on any space-time, we have that the Einstein tensor has this what is called covariant conservation, but it's not a conservation law. So I avoid using that term. So this is not a J, this is a semicolon. All right. So we will come back to that super important equation. Remember the overall strategy. Where are we on the map of this course? We, at some point, introduced the metric. And having the metric specified infinitesimal, to specify the metric is to specify infinitesimal distances on our space-time. And once we have infinitesimal distances, we have large distances. And once we know the large distances on the manifold, we can infer what the shape of the manifold is. And for example, imagine you're the curator of a museum of paleontology, and you have a huge dinosaur to look after. And it has been reconstructed with the skin and everything. And now you want to have an electronic record of your dinosaur. So you take a white paint and a paintbrush, and you put dots on the skin of the dinosaur. Lots of them, at some sort of grid. And then you measure the distances between those dots. And then you record the distances in your logbook. What have I done today? I recorded like a gazillion distances between white dots on the surface of a dinosaur. And then, as luck would have it, the museum burns down overnight, and the dinosaur is gone. But you still have your logbook. Then, with your logbook, having nothing but distances, and literally nothing else, right? And the white dots are just enumerated in some random way. You don't have any coordinate system or anything. You just have enumerated your white dots, and you have distances between white dots. From that alone, you can reconstruct your dinosaur, right? And that's why, knowing the metric, infinitesimal distances, like having really, really dense grid of your white points, right, you can get back the shape of the manifold. If you have the infinitesimal distances, you have the finite ones. And just in general, you know, it just wouldn't fit together any other way. So you get the shape. OK, but then we said, OK, that's one way to specify the shape of something. And then we considered another way to specify the shape of something. And in the essay, you know, you might want to consider those two and maybe some other methods of specifying shape as well, like deficiency angles, triangles having not 180-degree angle sum, and so on. So in any case, the second method for specifying the shape of a manifold was to specify it by specifying parallel transport, the affine connection, the covariant derivative. Because once we know how parallel transport is non-trivial, like when I parallel transport around a parallelogram, I come back and there's a rotation in the parallel transported vector, then I also know implicitly what the shape of the manifold is. And we made it more explicit by calculating from the affine connection that we specified what the torsion is and what the curvature is. So now let's assume that we specify the manifold by the original method. We specify the metric, like the curator of the museum, infinitesimal distances. We specified the metric. Now, there ought to exist an affine connection that specifies the same dinosaur. Right? So you have your logbook of distances, you have the infinitesimal distances, you have the metric. Now we ask, what affine connection does the same job and describes the same dinosaur, the same manifold? How does the metric determine the affine connection? There ought to be a way to go from the one to the other. And the crucial idea here is this. When we parallel transport vectors, we describe that using the affine connection. And we are looking for a way to relate that to the notion of metric. Now, when we parallel transport a vector, key property of that is that parallel transport will not make a vector shorter or longer. Parallel transport can mess with the direction of it as we go in a parallelogram, but parallel transport cannot mess with the length of a vector. It can also not mess with the relative angle of two vectors. If we have two vectors and we parallel transport both of them, then they shouldn't just get closer or further away from it. Right? They should not change their angle between them. Parallel transport means that if this one is parallel transported and that one is parallel transported, well, then they better keep the angle that they have between them. But remember how we calculate lengths and angles with the metric. We take the two vectors and we contract them against the metric, right? And then in the Riemannian case, what we would get is the length of the first times the length of the second times the cosine of the angle in between. So basically what we are saying is that the affine connection has to preserve the metric. It has to preserve the way in which angles and lengths are calculated. Explicitly, it looks like this. Let's say we have a path gamma in the manifold, and we have two vector fields, eta and nu, that are parallel transported along gamma. So we have a path. What really matters is not the path. It's just, you know, infinitesimal, just at the point, a tangent. But in principle, let's consider a path. And so along that path, gamma of t, the vector field eta at the point gamma of t is supposed to be parallel transported, which means that the covariant derivative in the direction of travel, gamma dot, is zero. Right? Remember, that's the autoparallel equation. It says that the change of the vector field as we travel along the direction gamma dot, which is the tangent to the path, is zero. And let's assume that another vector field is also parallel transported. So, you know, two vectors. One is like this, the other one is like that. We parallel transport both of them. So the nu is also a vector field. And if we look at the vector field's vectors along the path, then they change in the direction of the path, in the direction of gamma dot, by zero. So they're parallel transported. So let's assume that on the path gamma, both the vector field eta and the vector field nu are parallel transported. What we want is that the affine connection and the metric are compatible with each other in the sense that in this parallel transport, neither of the two vectors changes its length, as calculated by the metric, nor does the angle between them change, as calculated by the metric. So we want that the inner product obtained by taking vector, vector, and contraction with the metric stays the same as we travel along the path. And that is vector eta on the path times the vector eta nu along the path and then contracted with the metric. In the Riemannian case, this expression is simply length of this vector times length of that vector times the cosine of the angle between the two. Okay? That should not change along the path. So d by dt of this should vanish if the affine connection is the one that is describing the same manifold as the metric, if the two are compatible. But what is this? The time derivative of a scalar function along the path. Well, by the geometric definition of what a tangent vector is, this is what you get when you take the tangent vector gamma dot and apply it to that function. But applying the tangent vector to a scalar function is covariant differentiation. Remember that covariant differentiation on tensors is non-trivial. But covariant differentiation on scalar functions is just ordinary differentiation. Right? Remember that if you do a covariant derivative of a tensor, of a 5 tensor, then you're going to get 5 Christoffel symbols. Right? But if you do the covariant derivative of a scalar function, you get 0 Christoffel symbols. You just get the ordinary derivative. Right? Covariant derivative is always ordinary derivative of the coefficients and then plus Christoffel symbols, as many as you need to contract each one of the indices. So we can write this using the fact that by the geometric definition of tangent vectors, this is the application of the tangent vector gamma dot on the scalar function. But that is the covariant derivative of the scalar function in the direction of gamma dot. So this can also be written as g evaluated against eta nu, right? So we take these two tangent vectors and input them into this twofold covariant tensor to get a number, right? This is just like a Brian Aket again. It's just tangent vector, cotangent vector, and you evaluate them, covariant two tensor, and you evaluate against them. It's just another way of writing this. But we take the covariant derivative in the direction of travel. Now, if we write this out in coefficients, then what is it? The covariant derivative of this scalar entity in the direction of travel of gamma dot is, you take gamma dot, this is the direction vector, you contract that, and then here you have the scalar quantity that you're differentiating, the g contracting the eta and the nu. Now remember that the covariant derivative obeys the Leibniz rule. It's a derivation. And we have three functions in here. We have the metric, and we have the two vector fields that are being parallel transported. So that means that this semicolon here, this covariant derivative, is going to act on the metric, on this, and on that. The first term is where the covariant derivative acts on the metric, leaving the eta and the nu the same. The second term is where we leave the g the same, and we have the covariant derivative on the eta, leaving the nu the same. And the third term from the product rule is where we leave the metric the same, and the eta the same, and we covariantly differentiate the vector field nu. Now, that expression here, where we have that the vector field is covariantly differentiated in the direction of travel, that expression is vanishing because of this. The covariant derivative of the vector field in the direction of travel abstractly is zero, and abstractly it's this. Concretely, in terms of the coefficient functions, it's of course that. So this expression is vanishing. For the same reason, that expression is vanishing, because also nu is assumed to be parallel transport. And there we have it. We have that the requirement that lengths and angles don't change during parallel transport is that the following is zero. This expression, gamma dot A, here, gamma dot A, and then the covariant derivative of the metric contracted with these two vector fields is equal to zero. But here, the direction in which we travel doesn't matter. It should be true for all directions. It should be true for all vector fields. Therefore, that expression itself here, the covariant derivative of the metric, has to vanish. This is, of course, the main result. We have that this expression here has to vanish for in order for the covariant derivative, the affine connection, to be compatible with the metric. This expression has to vanish, but since it has to be true for any direction of travel, for any pair of vector fields, it has to be true that this expression is vanishing, which means that the covariant derivative of the metric in any direction has to be zero. Or we could also write down the absolute covariant derivative, just drop the xi and say that nab log g is equal to zero, because it's got to be true for all directions. So this is the main statement here. It means that if you're starting out by describing your manifold using a metric, then you may wonder, yeah, I don't like the metric. I want the affine connection to describe my manifold. How do I calculate the affine connection that describes the same manifold? The true radius of the dinosaur, you have your distances. But you want the affine connection. You want to know how the parallel transport on the surface of the dinosaur works. How do you do that? This is this equation you have to solve, or that is the equation that you have to solve. Now, how does that relate the two? Well, look, the metric is in here. The metric we assume as given, right? We want to calculate the Christoffel symbols. Where do they come in? Well, they come in here because of the semicolon, right? This expression is really the ordinary derivative of g plus Christoffel symbol, and then contracted with the b, plus Christoffel symbol contracted with the c. That's the covariant derivative of such a two tensor here. So this is an equation, actually, this one, is an equation that involves both the metric and the Christoffel symbol. So now the challenge is to solve that equation so that we get the affine connection in terms of the metric. Is this always possible? Here is the fundamental theorem of Riemannian geometry, which is also true for pseudo-Riemannian geometry, so also for the case of the Lorentzian signature. The fundamental theorem of pseudo-Riemannian geometry says that for every Riemannian absolute Riemannian manifold given by some manifold and some metric G, there exists a unique affine connection which doesn't have torsion and which is compatible with the metric in the sense that we just discussed, that angles and lengths of vectors are preserved under parallel transport. And that affine connection obeys this condition. This affine connection is called the Levi-Civita connection. You may wonder, what about torsion then? Well, there is a more general statement which says that whenever you have a manifold and a metric, and also a tensor field tau, which is antisymmetric in the two lower indices, and also has an upper one, so it's a two tensor with a two-fold covariant, one-fold contravariant tensor, just like the torsion tensor. So if you have a manifold with a metric on it, and you also have a tensor field that has the structure of a torsion tensor, in the sense that it has the same index structure, then there exists a metric-preserving affine connection, namely the Levi-Civita connection, which also has an antisymmetric part to it, which is the torsion. You see, once you've specified the Levi-Civita connection, you don't have a torsion there. Because Levi-Civita connection is an affine connection that is symmetric in the two lower indices. But you can always add to it an antisymmetric tensor. In fact, this is also interesting from another perspective. In principle, there is the question whether nature has torsion or not. And as we discussed earlier, it could well be that in principle it doesn't, but quantum fluctuations make us have some fluctuations into torsion. Or maybe there is torsion, maybe it is important in the very early universe, we just haven't noticed yet. Could be either way. But there is another way to look at these things. And this other way to look at this is to say the torsion is fundamentally not geometric. We interpreted the torsion as being fundamentally geometric, as parallelograms not closing. We were saying, okay, we do this way or that way, and then it doesn't close. Where we simply assumed parallel transport. Important thing being undisturbed parallel transport. Now, another way of looking at this is to say that there is no torsion. All infinitesimal parallelograms close, but there is an extra force in nature, which is described by a tensor field, which interferes with your parallel transport, such that what you thought is parallel transport is not parallel transport, and therefore it appears to you as if your parallelograms don't close. So what that means is that there may be a way out of the torsion conundrum, namely, instead of saying, I don't know if the geometry has torsion or not, it could be that this can be translated simply into saying, yeah, there never is any torsion. But it could be that there is a tensor field in nature that is one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant, which interferes with parallel transport in the way that torsion would. And then the question is, why haven't we observed a torsion field like that? Why haven't we observed in the standard model, for example, why do we not have any matter fields or radiation fields, anything like gluon fields or neutrino fields or whatever, that would have this structure? And the reason is, basically, we have an argument for that, coming from a completely different source, not general relativity, but from quantum field theory and renormalization. We know that a theory like this would be higher spin, would be spin 2. And they cannot be renormalized. Right? So if you look into the standard model, you will find only spin 0 fields, Higgs fields. You will find spin 1/2 fields. These are all the fermions, neutrinos, and electrons, and quarks. And then you will find spin 1 fields, like the W bosons, and the photons, and the gluons. No higher spin. And the reason is that, as one can show on general dimensional grounds, argument given by Weinberg, that such a theory of higher spin would not be renormalizable in 3 plus 1 dimensions. It would be in lower dimensions, but not in 3 plus 1 or higher dimensions. So therefore, we could in principle say, oh, we can kick back. Now we understood why there is no torsion. Because torsion need not be interpreted geometrically, could be interpreted as a force. But then if it were in the standard model, it would not be between spin 0 and spin 1, would be higher spin. We know this stuff cannot be quantized. That maybe is, cannot be renormalized. There would be uncurable divergences in quantum field theory. And therefore, yeah, that's why nature doesn't do it. Does anybody see a problem with this?
Could there be a part of gravity that doesn't quantize?
That's a good point. In fact, I just wrote a paper on this.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think so. Because there are general theorems that show that non-quantized theories do not mesh with quantized theories. You can't keep that unitary. The only escape route is that the non-unitarity may show up so late that it takes not just 13 billion years to show up, but maybe 10 to the 100 years to show up. Right? So that is a loophole, and that's what I addressed in that recent paper. Could it be that, you know, gravity is not quantized? And it is not unitary together with the full quantum theory, but the violations might be so small because the coupling between gravity and matter is so weak that it takes so long to show up. That's one possibility. Yeah, but there is actually another argument that kind of kills the argument that I just made about torsion. I'm not the first to make this argument about torsion. Wald, for example, is advocating the same point of view. No, the weak spot in this argument is that the torsion tensor is not the only tensor that is spin 2. Curvature tensor is too. I mean, the metric is, right? Which means that, yes, we know that there are fields in nature, the metric, the curvature, that are higher spin. Gravitons are spin 2. They definitely do exist. Well, we're not so sure about gravitons, but we are sure about gravitational waves and about gravity and curvature in general. This is higher spin. So renormalizability or not, it exists. Nature does not avoid spin 2. So therefore, since nature has found a way to make gravity compatible, it probably should have found a way to make torsion compatible too. Okay? So this is actually the fundamental difficulty, or one way of looking at the fundamental difficulty of why it is so hard to quantize gravity. It's too high spin for quantum field theory. The divergences are not renormalizable. I teach quantum field theory in curved space-time next term. So this is just a preview of some of the things that we'll cover. All right. Okay, so that's the fundamental theorem here of Riemannian geometry. Now that we know that it should be possible, let's actually do it. How do we get the Levi-Civita connection from the metric? Well, the fact that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing means that, well, this is the covariant derivative, right? So g mu nu semicolon alpha, when spelled out, is this. It's g mu nu comma alpha, the ordinary derivative, and then a Christoffel symbol contracted with this index, a Christoffel symbol contracted with that index, right? That's generally the structure of covariant derivatives of these coefficient functions. You get the leading term is the ordinary derivative always. And then you get as many terms as you have extra indices. In this case, we have two indices. So we get two terms with Christoffel symbols contracting those two expressions there. Now, here I wrote down the same equation just with the indices shifted a little bit, permuted a little bit, still true. I just renamed the indices. This, again, is the same equation renamed the indices. That's all. And then, and this is a trick that you can already read in Einstein's first publication, you just take minus of the first equation and plus the second and the third, take one half of that, and you obtain this equation. It involves the metric. It involves the Christoffel symbols, just like up here. But now in a much more manageable way. Because if we now contract, if we now multiply with another metric, with two upper indices. And that's the inverse of that metric. So we get rid of this term here, and then we simply have Christoffel symbol equal to some stuff. That's what we get. We get, and now I'm multiplying this equation from the left and from the right with the metric, with upper indices, contract that. And then here we just get a Kronecker delta, which we can get rid of by just renaming the variable. And then we obtain that the Christoffel symbol is equal to 1/2, and then this is the metric that I multiplied here to get rid of that one, to get contracted with this to obtain the Kronecker delta. And then this is just carried forward here. So what we have is that the Christoffel symbol is now expressed in terms of the metric and its derivatives. So for example, in Minkowski space, in Cartesian coordinates, this is just the eta matrix whose derivative is vanishing. And therefore, the Christoffel symbol is zero. But remember, I promised to show you that the Christoffel symbols also describe pseudo forces, like when you're on a carousel or bungee jumping or something like this. Strong accelerations, right? So imagine Minkowski space, but in funny coordinates, in accelerated coordinates. Well, then you get derivatives here because the metric is no longer going to be eta, it's going to be complicated. And it will have derivatives in here. Just because you went from the eta matrix as the metric by change of coordinate system, you get these two Jacobian matrix factors that are space and time dependent, like on a carousel, you get these metric coefficient functions that are complicated and have derivatives. And so you get the Christoffel symbol that's non-trivial there. So the fact that the Christoffel symbol is non-zero doesn't mean that we have curvature. It could be we have zero curvature, we just use funny coordinate system. Which is why it is important to express things in the curvature, in terms of the curvature tensor. The curvature tensor is a tensor, which means that if it is vanishing, well then it vanishes no matter what coordinate system you choose. It describes really the curvature directly. You can't make the curvature tensor non-zero by just choosing funny coordinates. But you can make the Christoffel symbol non-zero by choosing funny coordinates. OK, so now we have it. Now we can calculate from the metric what the Christoffel symbol is. So as the curator of your dinosaur museum, if you have all those distances, now you can calculate what the parallel transport on the surface of your dinosaur would be like. Because from the metric, from this infinitesimal distances, you can now calculate what the Christoffel symbol is, and that gives you the parallel transport of vectors. All right. Now, further upgrade of the math. As I mentioned at the beginning of the class today, we will finally make use of the fact that the bases in the tangent vector spaces and cotangent vector spaces can be completely freely chosen. We don't have to choose the basis of the d by dxi. And that's very useful because it means we can change coordinate system and keep the basis and therefore keep the coefficient function. Right? The coefficient functions, in any case, it's scalar functions. They only change if you change bases in your tangent and cotangent spaces. The coefficient functions of tensors only change if you change bases in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces. If you don't, coefficient functions stay the same, even if you change coordinates. Let's look at this in detail. OK, so we now choose arbitrary bases in our tangent and cotangent spaces. So let's say we choose, for the tangent spaces, basis vectors ei and dual vectors in the cotangent spaces theta I. This is what is called a choice of frame. So we choose at every point of our space-time four tangent vectors. They will be our basis vectors. And let's call them ei. I will later show you how we can actually go about specifying them if you want. And then once we've studied how we can make use of this freedom here, we will next also do another upgrade of the mathematics, which is, as I already mentioned at the beginning of this class today, that we will allow differential forms to be tensor value. An ordinary differential form is an antisymmetric covariant tensor. For example, a 3 form is waiting for 3 tangent vectors to be input, and then it's satisfied and the output is a number. A 2 form is waiting for 2 tangent vectors to be input and the output is a number. But a tensor-valued form is a little different. It's a bit more sophisticated. If you take, a 1-1 tensor-valued 3 form, then it's waiting for 3 tangent vectors to be input to satisfy the form part, and then the output is a 1-1 tensor. Okay? So instead of a differential form just outputting numbers once all of its slots have been filled, no. A tensor-valued form will output a tensor. That will be useful, for example, if there's going to be a tensor-valued curvature form, tensor-valued torsion form, because they're naturally of that format. They have antisymmetric lower indices, so they can be viewed as forms. But they also have other indices. So we take the antisymmetric parts and interpret them as forms, and then the remaining indices are the tensor-valuedness of them. It is useful, for example, because it's the forms, the differential forms, that we can integrate, right? And by doing this step now, we can integrate up not only differential forms, but tensor-valued differential forms. So we can integrate up tensor-valued things over submanifolds. Also, we will obtain powerful, simple equations that will relate the covariant derivative, the metric, the curvature, and the torsion. For example, the Bianchi identities will look simpler then. OK, so before we get started, let us disentangle the affine connection and the metric again. Remember, in principle, these are independent ways of specifying the shape of a manifold. You can either do it by specifying a metric or by specifying an affine connection. We've already seen how we can calculate the one from the other, but let's not do this just now. Let's just consider them to be separate descriptions of space-time for now. And also, we will again allow that there might be torsion. So now, moving frames. This is the business of choosing basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces individually, separately, independently of choices of coordinate system. OK, so what is a moving frame? A moving frame is the specification of a set of tangent vectors at every point of the manifold. Such that at every point of the manifold, this set of tangent vectors gives us a basis of the tangent vector space. So in space-time, at every point in the manifold, we commit to specifying 4 tangent vectors. And they've got to be linearly independent so that they span the tangent space. So a moving frame is such a specification. At every point in space-time, we specify 4 such vectors. So we have EI of space and time, functions of space and time. And then we denote the dual basis by theta I. Also, these guys are functions of space and time. I'm just dropping the XT in this, the XT bracket here to keep the notation uncluttered. Dual basis, remember, means that dual basis vectors have the property that when evaluated on our basis vectors, they just give the Kronecker delta. We could choose the basis of the cotangent vector space to be also completely wild and independent, but there's no benefit in that. It's usually easiest to just go along with the dual basis. Now, for n equal 4, this is called the Fierbein, which means 4 legs in Einstein's language. And in Greek, it would be a tetrad. And if you're working in more dimensions than 4, you might call it a Fielbein, which means many legs in Einstein's language. No, you're specifying at every point 4 vectors, right? So it's like 4 legs at every point in space and time. Okay. So every one of these covectors that we specify, covector basis vectors that we specify at at every point in space-time, is being a covector, being a cotangent vector, it is a 1-form, right? Trivially. Cotangent space is the space of 1-form. And then we can also look at the d of theta, and that's a 2-form then, because the d, the exit derivative of a 1-form, is a 2-form. See, already we have something non-trivial here, because previously, the basis that we chose in the cotangent space was the basis of the dxi, right? The dx1, dx2, dx3. And if you apply a d on them, it's 0. The d of one of these canonical basis vectors that come with the coordinate system is always 0, because d squared is equal to 0. But now these guys are completely arbitrary. There is no reason for d theta to be 0. It's just some 2-form. Okay, now a frame is a collection of cotangent vector and a tangent vector, tensor product between the two, at every point in space. So this is a form, this is a tangent vector, so we can view this as a 1-0 tensor, this guy, valued 1-form. The 1-form, use the cotangent vector, and if you satisfy that by putting a tangent vector in there, then you get a tangent vector out, which is a 1-0 tensor. So this is an example of a tensor-valued form already. It's a trivial one, but yeah, that's what it is. Here, I'm just saying that, as we already discussed, if you choose your basis vector to be the old-fashioned basis vectors that come with the Joseph coordinate system, dxi, well, then the d of theta is 0, because d squared is 0. But of course, that's not the choice we are going to make. In general, we will choose for our cotangent vectors, or tangent vectors, which are the dual vectors to it, we will choose for them some linear combination of these guys. So our ith basis vector is going to be some linear combination of these coordinate basis vectors. But we have them for free anyway. They come with the coordinate system. We don't have to use them for actual descriptions of tensors. But we can use them to describe the basis that we actually want to work with. Okay, so we choose a coordinate system, we get the dxi from that, and then every new basis vector is some linear combination of these canonical basis vectors. And the linear combination is this matrix here, the lambda matrix. You can also view it this way, that this lambda matrix gives you a change of basis from this basis to that basis. Okay. Now, what would happen to this equation if we change coordinate system? Well, then these vectors stay the same, but those change. So then you have that this matrix is changing, right? So as we change coordinate system, we can stick to our basis vectors. But of course, the way they're represented in terms of the new canonical basis that come to the coordinate system will change. So the lambda will change. And we will later get into this. Now, in general, because this has the space-time dependence in it, this is why the d theta I are going to be, in general, a non-trivial 2-form. Because if you calculate the d of theta I, the d of this, you get the d of all of that, right? Now, by the product rule, this is going to be the d on this, leaving that the same, plus leaving that the same and the d on this. The second term goes away because the d squared is 0. The first term survives, so we have the d on that. That's why we have that the d theta in general is a 2-form that's not vanishing. And what is that 2-form? So we can write the d theta I, which is some 2-form, as a linear combination of a basis in the space of all 2-forms. You see, these guys individually form a basis in the space of 1-form. The wedge product of any two of those gives us a basis in the space of 2-forms. Therefore, we know beforehand that this differential 2-form must be a linear combination of these basis vectors with some coefficient matrix. And that coefficient matrix is called the C matrix. And it is anti-symmetric, If you put a symmetric part in there, it's useless because it will drop out because of the anti-symmetry of the wedge product. I leave it to you as an exercise to calculate what the C matrix is given the lambda matrix. Okay? So now you know, in principle, how to do the following calculation. You choose a coordinate system, and you get with the coordinate system the dxj for free, right? Just write them down. And then you get to choose now what basis vectors you actually want to work with in the cotangent space, these guys, which means you choose some coefficient functions here. Make sure that this matrix is invertible, because otherwise it's not a change of basis. Right? If this is not invertible, these guys are not linearly independent. So make sure you choose an invertible matrix here at every point in space and time. And then you have your own choice of basis vectors in the cotangent space. And of course, that induces the dual basis vectors in the tangent space. So you've made that choice now. And that's just the choice of bases in your cotangent space. Now, for this bunch of basis vectors, for all of the cotangent spaces, you can calculate how the d theta is expanded in terms of this basis or in the space of cotangent. Of two forms, right? And that matrix C is determined fully by the matrix lambda. You can calculate that. It's a little exercise that's nice to do. Okay, so now that we have made use of our freedom to choose a basis in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces, let's calculate the coefficient functions of the torsion, curvature, metric, and Christoffel symbol in exactly the usual way. So we take our torsion tensor, and remember what it does. It takes in a torsion map. It takes in two tangent vectors, because it's twofold covariant, and it outputs a tangent vector, which we can then contract with a cotangent vector. So if we choose these basis vectors, then we end up with a number-valued function, the coefficient function of our torsion tensor. It's exactly the same thing that we would normally do with the d by dxk, d by dxl, and and this would be the dxi. Okay? And then that would be the coefficient function. Similarly, here for the Riemann curvature tensor, for the metric, you know, the metric is twofold covariant. You just plug in the two basis vectors that you've chosen now. They are not tied to a coordinate system. You've chosen them. Plug them in here, and you get the coefficient functions. And the same for the Christoffel symbols. Now, these coefficient functions are, again, scalar functions, right? But now, as we change coordinate system, we are no longer changing what the theta and what the e are. The lambda will change, right? So it's the same theta, the same e will be expressed with a transformed lambda in terms of the new canonical basis vectors, the d by dxi and dxi. But the basis vectors theta and e, we hold fixed, right? We don't change them as we change coordinate system. And therefore, what happens to these coefficient functions when we change coordinate system? Absolutely nothing. It's very important. Because in the traditional view of differential geometry, the physicist's view, we would say, oh, this index is contravariant, which means that under change of coordinate system, we expect that there is a Jacobian matrix transforming that index. No, no longer. Not here. Because we are no longer changing bases as we change coordinate system. We stick to that basis, and therefore, that expression is just always the same. It's just the same scalar function always. Now, let us consider an arbitrary change of frame. So now, let's keep, for example, the coordinate system the same, but we change bases. We can do that now. Right? In the past, these things came hand in hand. You change coordinate system, you change bases in the tangent space. Now, we can change coordinate system without changing the bases in the tangent space. Or we can keep the coordinate system and change bases in the tangent spaces. or of course both, completely free. The two things are independent. So now let's assume that we are doing a change of frame. So we are doing a change of the base of our choice of basis vectors, even while keeping the coordinate system the same. But then what do we have? So let's assume we change basis in the cotangent vector space. This was the old basis that we are no longer happy with for some reason. So now this is going to be the new basis, new set of basis vectors, and they are linearly related to the old basis vectors. And we allow ourselves to make a change of basis, a different change of basis at every point in space and time. This is like a gauge transformation, if you are familiar with gauge transformation in a standard model. So at every point in space and time, we allow ourselves now to choose new basis vectors that are expressed linearly in terms of the old basis vectors. And of course, the dual basis of tangent vectors transforms then with the inverse matrix, because they should be a dual basis if these guys are dual bases. Therefore, the contraction of this against that should be Kronecker delta, so this must be the inverse matrix of that one. Okay, so what happens if we change bases but don't change coordinate system? Let's come back to that in a moment. I'll show you once we have some non-trivial quantities to apply this to. Before we look into the transformation properties of tensors, let us look at these tensors whose transformation properties we want to investigate from that more advanced perspective that I indicated earlier, which is that just look at some tensors as tensor value differential forms. What is a tensor-valued p-form? An RS tensor-valued p-form, let's call it phi, is an antisymmetric p-multilinear mapping at each point of the manifold. You see, because it's a p-form, it will accept p tangent vectors as input. And so it maps p tangent vectors into an output, which is an RS tensor, an R-fold contravariant, S-fold covariant tensor. The fact that it takes p tangent vectors as input and is antisymmetric in that input makes it a p-form, because p-forms are totally antisymmetric covariant tensors, p-tensors. So they expect p tangent vectors to be fed. And then antisymmetrically, they map that into, in this case, RS tensors. Then so the output is an RS tensor. And an RS tensor, since it is R-fold contravariant, can be fed R co-vectors, cotangent vectors, and S tangent vectors to fulfill the R contravariant slots and the S covariant slots. And then it evaluates into a number. So if we take our differential form, our RS tensor valued P form, and we feed it R covectors to satisfy this R-fold contravariants, and also these tangent vectors to fulfill this, then this will be a number-valued function. But of course, it's still a p-form. So once you fill all of these slots of the RS tensor, then each one of these coefficient functions is an ordinary p-form, because it still expects p tangent vectors to be fed in order to output one of these RS tensors, which is then filled with all these inputs. So what would be special cases? We know these things, of course, already, at least in special cases. So for example, RS tensors, RS tensor-valued fields. Well, they are, of course, RS tensor-valued zero forms, because an RS tensor doesn't expect any tangent vectors to be fed so that it becomes an RS tensor. It's just an RS tensor, RS value tensor right away. So as a form, it's a zero form. On the other hand, what about a P form, a regular ordinary P form? It's a P form, all right, and it outputs a number or a function, a scalar function, which is a zero zero form. So therefore, a P form is automatically a zero zero tensor valued form. So this notion of RS tensor valued P form is generalized in both differential forms and tensors. This specifies the input, that specifies the output. And as I said, an advantage is that since we can integrate p-forms and only p-forms, it's good to have tensor-valued p-forms because then we can integrate also tensor-valued things. Now, concrete example. Remember that the torsion map, which takes in two tangent vectors and outputs a tangent vector, is antisymmetric. Takes in two tangent vectors, which is to say, and antisymmetric, which is to say it's a two form. It's an antisymmetric covariant tensor, but it outputs a tangent vector field. So therefore, because its input is twofold covariant antisymmetric, it is a two form, but the output is a tangent vector, so it's a 1-0 tensor valued two form. So we can take the torsion map, feed it two tangent vectors, and get out the tangent vector. And we can also view it this way, that this thing is a torsion two-form. See, if you drop that, then it's just a two-form, and it takes two inputs, as any two-form would. But its output is a tangent vector. And so you have here this index and the contraction with this basis of tangent vectors. So the whole thing takes two tangent vectors as input, but then the output is a tangent vector. So it is a tangent vector valued two form. That's what the torsion two form is. It's a tangent vector valued two form. The two form takes as its input the two vectors that describe the parallelogram along which you travel. And then the tangent vector that it outputs is the deficiency by which the parallelogram doesn't close. Okay, then if we choose a frame, so if we choose a basis in the tangent vectors, in the tangent vector and cotangent vector space, so we choose the basis vectors theta, for example, but then our torsion two form, our tangent vector or 1-0 tensor valued two form can be described this way. You see, it's a two form, so we have a coefficient function, and here it's multiplying this two form, and then here we have the coefficient function labeled by I for the tangent vector valued output. You have to contract that still with the EI to get the actual tangent vector. Remember, these are scalar coefficient functions. This is a two form. And then when you contract that whole thing with a basis vector in a tangent vector space, namely this one, then you get an actual tangent vector. Now, how about the curvature? Curvature is also two form. If you remember, the curvature map has the property that it also feeds on two tangent vectors antisymmetrically. Well, if you look at the matrix of the Riemann curvature tensor, the two indices that are anti-symmetric, here, the third and the fourth index are anti-symmetric. These are these two vectors. Again, just like for the torsion, these are the two vectors that you input to specify the parallelogram around which you're parallel transporting a vector and then checking by how much it rotated. Right? So what the Riemann curvature tensor does by the Ricci identity of previous lecture is this: you give it the two tangent, you give it the two direction vectors that specify the parallelogram, and then it outputs an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, which tells you by how much the vector rotated as you traveled around the parallelogram. And that rotation matrix, or that infinitesimal Lorentz transformation matrix, is the one tensor valued thing here. So our curvature 2 form, you see, after the third and the fourth index are interpreted because they are covariant and antisymmetric as the coefficients of a 2 form. But then we still have an upper and a lower index. So therefore, the Riemann curvature tensor can be viewed as defining a 1-1 tensor valued 2 form. And here it is, a 1-1 tensor valued 2 form. You plug in the two vectors that specify the parallelogram, and then you get this matrix that describes how the vector rotated with one upper and one lower index. And then if we choose a basis, a frame, for every point, a basis in the cotangent vector space, then if we take the Riemann curvature tensor's matrix, we take the third and the fourth index, view, contract them with a basis in the space of 2 forms. So we view these two indices as arising from a 2 form. We get a factor of 2 because of the wedge product, so we have a 1/2 in here. And then these two indices give us the 1-1 tensor valuedness of it. So overall, this thing has only two indices and still describes the Riemann curvature tensor. And how? Well, it's because the third and the fourth index are suppressed because they are now the form part of it. Right? So the Riemann curvature form displays only two indices, namely the upper one and the first lower one. The other two are suppressed. They're still there, but they're now considered to just be part of this thing being a differential form. Okay, so now we have a torsion form. The torsion form is a 2 form. The curvature form is a 2 form. The torsion form is a 1-0 tensor valued 2 form, and the curvature form is a 1-1 tensor valued differential form. And that's because the torsion simply describes a vector, namely the vector by which the parallelogram doesn't close. But the curvature describes a rotation. It tells you for every vector in which way it rotated as you parallel transport it around the parallelogram. Now, can we also describe the affine connection as a differential form? This is quite non-trivial because, you see, they're not tensorial, these guys. So these things are not tensors to start with. The Christoffel symbol is, of course, defined with respect to our choice of bases the same way that it was defined for any for the canonical choice of bases. Remember, here we had the affine connection, the covariant derivative of d by dxj in the direction of d by dxk is equal to Christoffel symbol and then d by dxi. Now we don't use these basis vectors anymore. We choose arbitrary basis vectors, but we still define the Christoffel symbols with respect to our choice of basis vectors now. But again, these guys are not tensors to start with. And that also, and also we have that there's no anti-symmetry in this at all. And there's no anti-symmetry in the kj, for example. Also, if we lowered that index, it still wouldn't be anti-symmetric. So it cannot be a 2 form. You look like it's paining you that it's not a 2 form. Well, but you see, you can still do what looks like a cheap trick, but it's fundamental. We can still view any of the covariant indices as the index of a 1 form. The 1 form is just any covariant index, right? It's just any covector is a 1 form. There's no anti-symmetry requirement there. So what we can do is we can say, this thing is a something-something valued 1 form. And the something-something, we still have to figure out what it is. So we define the connection 1 form So this is the Christoffel symbol now, where one index disappeared. It's under the hood now. Why? Because that index, this one, is now viewed as the index of a one form. So the connection one form is, by definition, the Christoffel symbol, and then contracted with one of these covariant indices. If there's no torsion, it doesn't matter which one of the two you're contracting with, right? So we're contracting here with the first one. So the connection one form is this. And what we expect, of course, is that these two indices are, again, kind of a Lorentz transformation, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, because it tells us by how much a vector changes as we parallel transport in the direction that we declare to be the one form. Remember that for the torsion tensor, for the torsion two form, and for the curvature two form, there were two forms. They expected two tangent vectors, and the two tangent vectors were the two tangent vectors that describe the parallelogram. For either parallel transport around or for checking whether the parallelogram closes or not. Now, for the connection one form, it's a one form. It expects one vector, one tangent vector to be fed. And that tangent vector is the direction in which we want to covariantly differentiate. And then the output is the rate of change of our vector. And that's described by a matrix, right? So you take your vector and then multiply it with that matrix. So that matrix is something like the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, because it tells you how a vector's coefficients change under parallel transport in the direction given by whatever vector we feed this one form. Okay, so the covariant derivative in the xi direction of E of a tangent vector is then given by, well, take the direction in which you want to differentiate and feed it into this one form part of our Christoffel symbols. The connection one form. The connection one form eats up as a form. It eats up the direction vector in which you want to differentiate. And then the output is a kind of rotation matrix that tells you how each basis vector is rotated. Like the, in this case, the J basis vector is rotated in the direction of this linear combination there. So that was the covariant derivative for tangent vectors. And then we can calculate from that, as we did previously, the covariant derivative of the cotangent on applied to cotangent vectors. So here we are covariantly differentiating our choice of basis vectors in the tangent space. Here we are covariantly differentiating our choice of basis vectors in the cotangent space. And you see it's very much the same matrix here, except with a minus sign. And the, it's just like we used to have in the basis of the canonical basis of the d by dxi, very similar. And here's the proof of it. The proof is based on the fact that the the theta and the e are canonical dual bases to each other. So if we take the inner product between, or the evaluation of one against the other, we get the Kronecker delta, which is of course constant on the manifold. We calculate the covariant derivative of this, has to be zero. Covariant derivative of a constant function is of course zero. It's a scalar function, so the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative. But we can also write it as a covariant derivative. And as such, it obeys the Leibniz rule. So we can also apply, we can write this by the Leibniz rule as the covariant derivative applied here, leaving that the same here, plus the other way around. We are using here the fact that contracting indices and covariant differentiation commute. This is something that we built into the construction of the affine connection at the very beginning. Remember that. OK, and then what we have is that this is the thing that we want to calculate. And that is what we already have. We know what the covariant derivative here. We know what the covariant derivative of a tangent vector is. We just don't know what the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector is. So one of the expressions we already have in terms of the omega. The other one we still need to determine. The whole thing is equal to zero. So therefore, we get that from that we obtain this with a minus sign. Very analogous to how we calculated it in the canonical basis. Now, connection one forms are not tensorial. Remember, we did this business of the tensor value differential forms as an intermediate thing. What we are really wanting to study is how do things transform when we leave the coordinate system the same, but we change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces. We're now ready to look at examples of that. So we said, assume we had originally this choice of basis vectors in the cotangent space. Now we want other basis vectors. And here is the change of basis matrix, which at every point in space-time is an invertible matrix. Then how do our coefficient functions change? So for example, the connection one form changes in the following way. We started with the omega ij. Remember, it's really the Christoffel symbol. The third index is hidden because it's a one form. So here's the connection one form. And then under a change of bases in the cotangent and tangent spaces, we have that the curvature one form in the new coordinates with the bar on top, these has as coefficient functions these coefficients given in the following way. Here's the change of basis matrix, inverse of the change of basis matrix, and then other stuff that doesn't even depend on the curvature one form. Now, if the curvature one form was tensorial, if it was a tensor like almost everything else, if it was a tensor, then this is what we should expect. Right? Because the change of basis vectors here, we know already in a special case, namely when we choose our basis vectors to be the ones that come with a coordinate system, like d by dxi. As we change coordinates, we change from d by dxi to d by dxi bar. And then these A were simply the Jacobian matrices. The change of basis, the Jacobian matrices that we get that transform the coordinates are just those A matrices, except now it's way more general, because they don't have to be Jacobian matrices. What we are saying is that even when you don't change coordinates, even if you simply just change bases, then you get these change of basis matrices. If you change, if you commit to changing bases in the tangent space, always in parallel to choosing your coordinate system, well, then you, all your change of basis matrices are Jacobian matrices. But that's just a special case. You don't have to make that choice. So in particular, if you change coordinate system, but you don't change the basis vectors, then your A is the identity, and the Christoffel symbols don't change. OK, so even if we keep the coordinate system the same, but we change bases in our basis vector, in our tangent spaces, then this is going to be the transformation rule. let's see how that comes about. Here we have the connection one form, and we contract with the new basis vector. This is as a the output of this is the same this is the covariant derivative in the direction of psi, because that's what we fill in here, of the theta bar vectors. So maybe I should have written this on the very left here. So the covariant derivative in the basis of the theta bar, of the basis vectors of the theta bars in the direction of psi is given by that. Just the definition of what the covariant derivative is. But then this is by the change of basis that. And now you see that because this has a space-time dependence and that has a space-time dependence, the covariant derivative will pick up on both of them. And you get two terms, and we don't really have time for the details of that, but you can quickly check that you get these two terms because of that. So it's fundamental that we get that the coefficients of the connection one form do not transform in the same way that the tensor would, which would be this. We get that. And of course, you've seen this before in the special case, where the change of basis came about because we changed coordinates, and we chose to change basis along with that. And that was just a Jacobian matrix. And then we had here the derivative of the Jacobian matrix and an inverse Jacobian matrix. Okay. Right. Whereas all the other tensors, like the torsion two form, the curvature two form, they all transform as expected just with the A matrix in place of the Jacobian matrix, simply because that's what happens when we change basis. It's just linear algebra. You change basis in a vector space, and then you get the change of basis matrix there. Okay. Now, remember that we generalized the notion of tensor field, and we generalized the notion of differential form to tensor value differential forms, so that, for example, we can integrate tensor valued stuff. Now, there is an analogous generalization of derivatives. Remember, we have the exterior derivative for differential form. And we also have the covariant derivative for tensors. But now we have tensor value differential form. And there is a derivative that does the job of both the exterior derivative and the covariant derivative that can act on the tensor value differential form. So it generalizes the covariant derivative and the exterior derivative. Whenever it acts on just a differential form, it's the D. Whenever it acts on just a tensor, that's a zero form, then it's the covariant derivative. But it generalizes this to tensor value differential form. So here's a proposition, namely that such a thing exists. For every RS tensor valued P form phi, there exists a unique RS tensor valued P plus one form, because remember that's this property of D, that it takes P forms into P plus one forms, which is then called D phi, whose components relative to our choice of basis theta are these. And that requires a little bit of reminding. So it is like the exterior derivative in the sense that, imagine if there were no indices. So if our phi has no indices, it's just a differential form. It's not tensor valued, right? If the phi has lots of indices, then it's definitely tensor valued, right? But if it has no indices, then it's just a differential form. And the capital D is doing what? Well, then it's doing the little d on that. Remember, no indices here in this special case. And it will take the P form into P plus one form. And these guys will all be gone, because here we have a connection one form contracting every one of those indices individually, with a plus for the contravariant ones, with a minus for the covariant ones. Just like the covariant derivative always does. It starts with the ordinary derivative, and then it does Christoffel symbols. And the omegas are Christoffel symbols with one index suppressed because it's interpreted as a form. So if phi is a differential form that's 0, 0 tensor valued, no indices, then it's just this. On the other hand, if the phi is tensor valued, has a bunch of indices here, but as a form it's trivial, it's a zero form, then what do we have? Well, then we have all the right stuff for covariant derivatives of tensors, and this becomes the ordinary derivative, because the d on a function is just the partial derivatives multiplied with the dxi. Right? So what we see here is that in the special case where phi is either just purely a form or purely a tensor-valued field, we get either for the tensor-valued field case a covariant derivative, where this is just the leading partial derivative term, and then the Christoffel symbols. Or if phi is actually not a tensor, not tensor-valued at all, but it's just a differential form, then these guys are gone because there are no indices to contract with, and this is just turning this differential form into a P form into a P plus one form. So it's generalizing these notions. And one can prove things for this, namely that it is an antiderivation and special cases are, as we discussed, that if it's just a P form, if our phi is a P form, then the D is just the exterior derivative. If our phi is just a tensor, but if a zero form, then it's the covariant derivative, the absolute covariant derivative. Okay, now, if we choose for the basis vectors, just the canonical ones that come with a coordinate system, then you can convince yourself that you just get the expected formula with the Christoffel symbols there instead of the omegas. You're just making one index visible again. So now that we have all this machinery, what is it good for? Do we get any simplification in the complicated formulas that we had before, for example, for the Bianchi identities? And indeed, we get some simplifications now. Proposition, and I leave it to you as an exercise to check, an affine connection, nabla, is metric. So it describes the same manifold as a metric, if and only if the absolute derivative of G is zero. Now, that shouldn't be too surprising. It's not much of an exercise, because it's not a form. Right? G is not a form. It's a zero form. The metric is a zero form. So it's just tensorial. And if it's tensorial only, then the capital D is just nabla. So it says that the covariant derivative of G is zero, which is what we had before. The Levi-Civita connection is obtained by requiring that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing, which is to say, distances and angles are supposed to be preserved under parallel transport. The distances and angles being described by the metric, the parallel transport described by the affine connection. That's the equation that links the two together. Now, in a new language where we don't have Christoffels, but where we have the connection one forms, this is how it looks like, right? It's the dg minus this. But it's just what you would expect with the Christoffel symbols. Now, we can also prove the so-called Cartan structure equations. They are super useful because they are just telling us how the torsion form, what the torsion form is in terms of the ingredients. We used to express the torsion in terms of the Christoffel symbol. Namely, it was the antisymmetric part of it. And we used to express the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of Christoffel symbols as well. Remember, it was Christoffel symbol derivative plus derivative of Christoffel symbol plus squares of Christoffel symbols. Now, this is the same stuff, just rewritten in the new language. So this is the torsion one form. The torsion two form, which is 1,0 tensor valued, which is why there's just one index up. And the two covariant indices of the torsion tensor are suppressed because it's a two form, right? Okay, so this is the torsion tensor. And the Cartan structure equation tells us that the torsion tensor can be expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbol in this way. This is the Christoffel symbol. And the curvature tensor, which used to be expressed in rather complicated ways in terms of four terms of quadratic and derivatives of the Christoffel symbol, is now this. So the Cartan structure equations tell us how to calculate the torsion tensor, how to calculate the curvature tensor, but in the form of the torsion two form and the curvature two form. And what for us most important, of course, is this one, because the torsion we assume to be vanishing. And so as far as the vanishing torsion is concerned, we simply have that zero equal to this, which means that d theta is this, which is cool, right? Because remember, d theta is something we calculated previously in terms of these C coefficients and so on, right? And now we see that if there's no torsion, that the d theta is simply that, Christoffel symbol veg theta, super quick. So if there is no torsion. We can also write the torsion to form now as d of theta, because if you look at this, this is actually just the capital D of theta. Remember why? Because the d is both the exterior derivative and the covariant derivative. So it does the exterior derivative here, but it does the covariant derivative for that index there. Okay, and then the curvature tensor, the curvature 2 form, is expressed in this way. Remember the curvature tensor, Riemann curvature tensor, was derivative of Christoffel symbol plus derivative of Christoffel symbol plus square of Christoffel symbol plus square of Christoffel symbol with various index structures. And here we get the same thing, just more compact. Derivative of the Christoffel symbol, right? Because omega is the Christoffel symbol. The d applied to that will differentiate it. And here we have omega veg omega. That's Christoffel times Christoffel if you spell it out in a basis. So it's just a more compact and transparent way of expressing the curvature in terms of the quantities that we are dealing with. All right, so I will skip the proof of this. I just gave you an example of a proof of the first one, not the torsion one, but the curvature one. And let's just skip that proof. What can we now do with the Cartan structure equations? So remember, the Cartan structure equations tell us how to calculate the torsion and how to calculate the how to calculate the curvature. And for example, later on, I will show you how to do this for cosmology or for black holes. And ordinarily, this is a festival of indices, right? When you try to calculate the solutions to the Einstein equations. But on this level of abstraction, it will be much faster. We can solve the Einstein equations much faster because it's much more compact, much more powerful way of writing things, as we will see later on. OK, so use of the structure, the Cartan structure equations. So this allows a proof of a simple formulation of the Bianchi identities. So the first Bianchi identity, remember, these are identities that hold no matter what, independent of the physics, just mathematical properties. So the first Bianchi identity tells us that the absolute covariant exterior derivative of the torsion 2 form is given by this, and the derivative of the curvature 2 form is vanishing. So that's obviously useful because it comes up in various calculations. So therefore, when the connection is metric and there is no torsion, so when the metric and the connection describe the same space-time, and we assume that there is no torsion, then we have that the torsion 2 form is vanishing, that the relationship between the metric and the affine connection is this one, which, if you remember, is simply to say that the covariant derivative of the metric is 0. And we have that the torsion is vanishing. So we have that this property holds. The right-hand side is vanishing because the torsion is vanishing. And we have that the total covariant exterior derivative of the curvature 2 form is also vanishing. So these are useful things which, if spelled out explicitly, would be much tedious. And then finally, let us look at something more down to earth, more pedestrian. Remember, we said, imagine you have the metric. You want to calculate what the affine connection is, right? So you are the curator of this museum, and you have the metric, you have all the infinitesimal distances between the white spots on the surface of the dinosaur, but you want to know the affine connection, how the parallel transport works on the surface of the dinosaur. Then we had a formula for that. We calculated it with Einstein's trick. Remember, there was this equation that we wrote down 3 times with permuted indices, and then we added them up, and then we got this expression. Now, that was still for the choice of basis in the tangent space that comes with the coordinate system. Now we're completely free to choose whatever basis we want. And this is now the formula. I will not prove it, just show it to you for 2 reasons. One is, you will see it's a little more complicated. You need to know that. But secondly, to make you aware that this is not trivial. And you can't just take any formula that you know from the case where you chose coordinate bases and expect it to still hold for arbitrary bases. So the connection, the relationship between the metric and the Christoffel symbols is in reality fully this one. Right? So it has six coefficients instead of just three, six terms instead of three. If you choose for your coordinate bases, if you choose for your tangent and cotangent spaces, the bases that come with the coordinate system, then the first line is gone, and we have just this, which we calculated before. Now, why is it that the first line is gone then? Remember what the C matrix was? If you take the bases in the cotangent vector space, the theta I, and you calculate d theta I, then it is a linear combination of the theta A veg theta B, basis vectors in the space of two forms. And the coefficient matrix is the C's. But if your basis vectors are the dxi, well, then the d of that is zero, and therefore you don't have these C coefficients. Right? So all of these go away. So a price to pay for going to arbitrary bases is that actually the relationship between the metric and the affine connection is a little more complicated. Right? So, oh, here I have it, right? If you remember the d theta have this expansion, has have this expansion matrix in terms of these basis vectors, but if these are the dxi, then d squared I, d squared xi is of course zero. And so therefore the matrices C are vanishing, and all of that is gone. Further, we also calculated what the Riemann curvature tensor is in terms of the Christoffel symbols, and we got derivative of theta of gamma, derivative of gamma, and then square of gamma, as we discussed earlier. Now, we also have this term in blue here, which involves the C matrix. Again, that term goes away if you choose for your bases, the coordinate bases. But on the other hand, we don't have to work with this complicated formula, because if you remember from the Cartan structure equation, we can express the curvature two form much more compactly now in terms of omega. Right. Okay, so far for today. Okay, we are almost done with all the math, and then finally we can get into the physics of it. Okay. Any questions? If not, then I'll see you on Friday.